I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Every morning, we awake to a world marvelously alive. Where do we encounter awe and wonder in this world? In animals and plants, in deserts, on mountains, in forests, ocean, and sky, in history, art, and science, in human striving and human kindness. Join us as we quest for the awe and wonder of knowing we are part of something infinitely larger than ourselves. Sarah and I, on our honeymoon, pulled up to a roadside shop for rockhounds. Now, rockhounds we are not, but we bought a couple souvenirs, two small rocks of obsidian. Jet black obsidian, when polished, shines and is smooth and you want to touch it. These small igneous wonders once flowed as hot lava, but taken in the palm of the hand today, they're cool and comforting. Is this sense of comfort from something so simple real or an illusion? Sarah and I have kept these two samples of mere physical material all through our marriage. We humans can grow attached to tangible stuff. Have you ever loved and treasured a physical object like these smooth black rocks? I mean, they're just things, aren't they? Obviously, the things we hold dear need not be small enough to fit in your hand. Even big stuff can feel comforting, the way a house becomes a home. Sometimes external things can even feel like extensions of our very selves. Now, with all of that said, smaller than a house and bigger than pebbles of obsidian is a physical wooden instrument with strings called a cello. Our guest for this episode of Constant Wonder is a cellist who holds her instrument dear. She won't shy away from saying that it's an extension of her own body. And just how radically woo-woo is that? Well, she's not the first musician to have this feeling about a tangible object. Most any of us, musician or not, can identify with this sense of affection or attachment to something that's just a thing. All you have to do is reflect for a moment on some object that you've kept and that you care about. That first pair of eyeglasses from childhood that you can't part with. Or a worn-out teddy bear or baseball glove that's just so much a part of you, you can't bring yourself to say goodbye to it. Kate Kennedy writes that a cello is an object so resonant with meaning that it can reflect ourselves. As for her own cello, she sometimes doesn't even know where her own person ends and her cello begins. Kennedy is author of the book Cello, A Journey Through Silence to Sound. Kate, as I've gotten to know you through your book, the Kate Kennedy that I find there is deeply passionate about her cello. That goes without saying. But even more than that, this passion has given you a strong desire to identify with the life stories of other cellists whom you write about in your book. These are musicians who almost certainly identified with their instruments the very same way you identify with yours. But before we talk about another cellist whom you profile in your book by the name of Pal Herman, let's talk about your story. And here's what I'm hoping you'll do for us. I would like you to take us to your formative years when you first were dreaming of becoming a professional cellist and then those hopes got dashed when you sustained a significant arm injury. This has been a long-lasting problem. It even remains a mystery today. It just happened and hampers your ease of playing. So where should this backstory begin for us now?
I got a government scholarship to go to a very special music school where everybody was a very serious musician. And it was like dying and going to heaven instead of being this weird geek who had to pretend they didn't spend their life playing cellos. And I practiced like crazy because I was so thrilled to be there. And then one day something just snapped. There was this really sort of hot blaze of pain down the side of my left arm. And I just couldn't use it. I couldn't use my third or fourth fingers. It was completely weak. It hurt like crazy. And I thought it would go. got a sling from the matron at the school, you know, kind of gave it a rest for a few days, and I couldn't touch, I couldn't press down on the fingerboard of the cello. And the school didn't really know what to do. I didn't know what to do. There wasn't really much guidance and advice at the time about musicians and injuries. And so that was that. I learnt my cello music in silence, and I sat with the cello and sort of held it but couldn't play it, and imagined what it was like to learn. I learnt all the Bach suites from memory without ever playing them, and learnt the Elgar Cello Concerto without, you know, imagining the shapes that I would make and the fingerings I would use. And it was a really terrible, terrible time.
I can only imagine incredible grief.
Well, I think I hadn't acknowledged the incredible grief. And I think there's something really interesting about a very career-limiting injury when you're in your late teens. And even though, you know, I'd reached a pretty decent standard and it was very clear that that was going to be my life, I'm not Jacqueline Dupre. You know, I hadn't had a kind of huge international career as a soloist and then was struck down by tragedy. So there is a sort of feeling that you can't really claim that grief. Worse things happen at sea, you know. So there is that. There's a kind of English reticence about really digging into that grief.
As year after year went by, Kate, having become a writer and a producer, never left cello playing completely behind. Yet even with physical therapy and an initial concerted effort to reclaim what she has lost, this once central focus of her life got pushed more and more to the periphery.
I remember a really key moment where my husband, who's a very, very distinguished musician, said suddenly out of the blue, why don't you play the cello much anymore? And it was like he'd pressed on a bruise I didn't know I had. It almost made me cry almost immediately. And I thought, I'm carrying that around. Yeah, what a good question. Why don't I?
The door that opened for Kate's return to public performing hinged on a growing hunger she had to know more about her own deeply personal, even visceral connection to this instrument by way of examining other cellists' relationship to their instruments and their life stories. In the years between her injury in her teens and then her eventual return to playing, Kate's career had taken her into writing and broadcasting. She's a research fellow at Oxford, associate director of the Oxford Center for Life Writing, and a regular presenter on history and culture for the BBC. So as her complex feelings of affection for the cello resurged after many years of looking mostly the other way, she found herself exploring the life trajectories of four cellists in history who had suffered setbacks of their own, whether in the form of persecution, injury, or misfortune. A vision of writing something about all this came into view for her, something part biographical and part autobiographical, and the project led her, in spite of her arm trouble, to playing actively once again.
And so I thought, right, I'm going to write about this, and I did, and it's been this wonderful self-fulfilling prophecy, because actually, through the course of 4 or 5 years of writing about cellos and going all around Europe with my cello, playing to people, building relationships through music, I've got more playing now than I know what to do with. I can't fit it all in, you know, and I'm known as a cellist now, which is fabulous and not something I ever expected. I think the cello for me is a portal. It's a way into thinking about lives, my own and more interestingly, other people's. So I think it's that. I think I am fascinated by the object and I've loved paying attention to it, looking at it, making one, sort of really digging into what a cello is, its history, who made them, what wood it's from, how you age the wood, whatever. But actually, it is a portal. It's a way into thinking about the people that held it and shaped it and lived with and around it. You're only getting half the story if you just have the physical me. And with my cello, I was complete. And that was very interesting as a biographer, particularly interesting. You know, what makes a person? What is someone's identity? And how do you capture that on the page if you don't even understand your own?
You just said, with my cello, I was complete. I want to point out that that is not an idiosyncrasy of yours. That feeling is shared with other cellists, and so many other musicians that I have met feel like their instrument is practically an extension of their own body.
Yeah, it absolutely is. You know, it's the size of a human torso. It even has the language of the human body. We describe a cello as having shoulders and ribs and a back and a neck. And like it's a human. and we keep it resonating against our lungs, you know, against our heart. That's where the cello touches. It's like a big hollow organ. And it's, you know, it's held against our body. We spend more time in physical contact with a cello than we will with any human in our lives if we are a very serious player. So it holds something of the player's touch, of our sweat, of the patterns in which we move our hands up and down the fingerboard. All of that I find really fascinating. This sort of symbiotic, reciprocal relationship between instrument and player, and the, you know, the intertwining of the cello.
Of the four cellists whose lives are depicted in Kate's book, we have chosen to highlight but one, an artist of the early 20th century by the name of Pal Herman. The story of Pal Herman's life comes to a tragic end. The life of his cello, however, has carried on into the present day. Kate Kennedy clearly has deep admiration for this now mostly forgotten musician. Who was Pal Herman? Was he an important musician? When did he live? Just situate him in history for us.
Pal was born really at the turn of the century. He was a Hungarian cellist and composer, equally brilliant and distinguished at both. And he was a great chamber music player. He played in the big quartets at the time. And he also played Baroque music, very interestingly, and it was quite untrendy at the time to do so. He was Jewish, very assimilated, not really aware of his Jewishness until he was living in Berlin in the 1930s, when, of course, being Jewish is a horribly distinguishing feature. And he was hounded out of Berlin. He was forced into the Netherlands, then from there to Brussels, from there to Paris, basically just hounded around Europe. But very early on in his teens, he was already celebrated as kind of one of the great soloists and chamber musicians around in Europe at the time. When Pal came to play in London as a very young prodigy, he had, you know, this very average German cello with him, and he performed on it. And then Louise Bachien and Jaap de Graaff, who were these benefactors of the arts, hosted a party in their London house, very near the Wigmore Hall, in fact. And Pal was apparently dancing with his German cello and managed to spill wine down it. It had some kind of accident. He was such fun. He had such energy and life about him. And I just imagine him whirling around with this cello and then getting it splattered with wine and scratched and dented and goodness knows what. So he had to take it into a cello shop the next day, and I found the records in their logbook of instruments coming in. You know, this wonderful young player with this terrible cello came in, and he's got scratches and wine down it. And so that was how Pal managed to injure his very average cello. And I think that was the opportunity for Jaap de Graaff and Louise Bachien to think, okay, this guy needs a cello. He needs something much better than this. What can we do? We want to step in. So they did what great philanthropists do and should do more. They went to a really elite instrument shop in Paris and bought this extraordinary Galliano cello for Pal. It was, you know, it was sort of a permanent loan, but there was no way he'd ever actually be able to buy it. It was a gift. And that was how Herman met his wife, Ada, who was their niece. So he had this incredible gift, this incredible support. And the cello went with him everywhere, you know, all around Europe, played in all the great concert halls. And it was a very distinctive instrument. He was extremely lucky to have it.
I want to share some useful context for you here before Kate brings the Nazi Gestapo into the story. After their marriage, Ada and Pal initially settled in Berlin, where in 1932 they were delighted to welcome a daughter, Cori, into their family. But this young family's bliss was short-lived. Staying in Berlin became all but intolerable. Pal went from being known as a celebrated cellist to being regarded first and foremost as just one more troublesome Jew, less than human. So as things grew ever worse, the family packed up to take their holiday in the Dutch countryside, knowing they would actually not be returning to Berlin. During this respite with Otto's extended family, Otto went with cousins for a swim at the beach and was caught in a riptide. Even though she was rescued, she had inhaled so much water that she was barely alive, and Pal spent nearly every day for months by her side in the hospital. She never recovered. The immediate cause of death was pneumonia. At the time of her mother's passing, little Corey was only 1 year old, and her father, Pal, was distraught, depressed, unemployed, not permitted to work in the Netherlands. He grew more and more concerned about his identity as a Jew, his lifestyle moving nomadically from one hotel to the next as he got performance gigs. Well, that was far from ideal for raising a small child. So Pal left Corey in the keeping of his non-Jewish in-laws in the Netherlands. He managed to continue playing and composing across Europe, though obviously not within the borders of anti-Semitic Germany. Pal was in France when on September 3rd, 1939, 2 days after Germany invaded Poland, the French formally declared war against Hitler and his regime.
He joined up very briefly for about 2 weeks before the French army was defeated, and then went into hiding further south in France, and from there was arrested by the Gestapo in Toulouse, was rounded up, we think, in a street raid. And at the time when he was taken away to the internment camp, his cello had been left behind in his flat in Toulouse. And the flat was sealed by the Gestapo, which was standard procedure, because, of course, all your things became German property. But somehow, incredibly, and I still do not know how, he managed from his cattle truck as it was heading off from the internment camp in Paris, he managed to write a note to relatives near Toulouse and throw it out of the little gap in the cattle truck. And somehow, incredibly, somebody found it and got it to its addressee, his cousin Jan Wevers near Toulouse. And Jan realized that the cello had been left behind and that there was nothing he could do for Pal, but the cello could be saved. And Jan cycled under curfew to Toulouse, managed to obtain a rubbish student cello, broke into the flat, which is, of course, under Nazi guard, that he could have been shot if he'd been caught. Any neighbor could have seen him at any time. And with, I think, the help of a instrument dealer in the town, managed to swap this, you know, worthless student instrument for Pal's cello, which was a beautiful, very, very special instrument by a maker from Naples called Niccolo Galliano. Very rare. There's only about 9 Galliano cellos in the world made by Niccolo. And this is a particularly beautiful instrument. So he shoved it in the case, poked it back out through this tiny window, God knows how, and cycled off into the night in danger of death. And then in the 50s, the family needed some money for Pal's now orphaned daughter's education. Nobody played the cello, it needs maintaining. So they sold it. But it then kind of gets very murky and it's very hard to work out. I think they were probably ripped off. It's very hard to work out what happens to the instrument, but it changes hands and changes hands and then it vanishes.
Later in this episode of Constant Wonder from BYU Radio, we're going to learn from Kate about the fate of this instrument and, tragically, the fate of this Hungarian cellist. We'll also get to hear some of Kate's personal experience as she traced the path of Pal Hermann across Europe in order to piece together his legacy. But just briefly, we are going to press pause on the somber tones of this story to bring you a short interlude, an entr'acte, if you will. We're going to hop back across the English Channel and forward in time to a day when Kate visited an orchard where, under truly bizarre circumstances, a cello has been installed like a statue out in the open air. It's a cello she got a chance to put her hands on and play when most of us wouldn't want to go anywhere near it. I'm Marcus Smith, bringing you Constant Wonder. I want to recommend another BYU Radio podcast that I think you'll really enjoy. It's called Uncomfy, Sticking with Moments That Challenge Us. It's brand new and it has video as well as audio. If you're someone who wants to engage with others on important topics, but you're not sure just how, or maybe you're burned out on social media and you wish you could bring some humanity back into discussions in real life, maybe still online, maybe not, well then Uncomfy is for you. You're going to hear real people describing challenging moments when they decided to stick with the discomfort. And in the process, they found some community healing or learned how to talk about what matters to them or simply discovered greater empathy in their relationships with others. And you can do it too. New episodes of Uncomfy, Sticking with Moments That Challenge Us, drop every Wednesday. And you can listen or watch on the BYU Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
There is this fabulously eccentric physicist in Nottingham in the UK whose wife is a cellist, and he is one of the world experts on honeybees. So with his incredible creative mind, he put the two together, found a cello and a skep that had been thrown away, and decided that actually, because bees are better than humans, better organized, they don't fight each other, they deserve a cello more than us humans do. So he took the cello, put it in the middle of an orchard, filled it full of bees, and the bees love it. They behave differently from any other colony, which is really fascinating. And I had this amazing opportunity to go and meet this cello standing sculptural and isolated in the middle of this orchard, meet its inhabitants, and play Bach to them and see what they would do.
Now, when you say you played Bach to them, didn't you sort of play Bach around them?
Yeah, around them, with them, in duet with them. And one of the amazing things about it is that they listen through their legs. They listen through vibration because they don't have ears. When you vibrate their home, they just kind of go sort of almost imperceptibly calmer because they're sort of pausing in their daily business and listening and paying attention. It's a wonderfully mindful feeling. And you can hear with headphones on the change in tone in the hive. And then when you finish playing, they just kind of carry on doing what they were doing before.
Well, I'm imagining this as best I can. As the fingerboard comes down in the strings, there are those little F holes. Does that become the entrance to the hive? Or how does this look?
Yeah, it does, which is fabulous. So what he's done is take the back off a cello and build a wooden prop so that the cello stands up by itself. Even that makes it look more like an installation than an instrument. It's very sort of odd and disarming.
Kate explained to me that this cello's wooden back has been replaced with plexiglass, allowing you to see the interior of their new home and what they're up to.
So you can see around the back of it. It's absolutely black with honeycomb and thick with bees. You can see them all kind of swarming around. And on the front, they pop themselves out of the F holes and fly off to go and get their nectar. And then when they try and come back in, it's a little bit harder to navigate because obviously it's a small aperture. So quite often they miss the F holes altogether and crash land on the strings. So, you know, when I say I played to and with the bees, they were also playing the cello as well. There's this amazing medley of pinging and thumping and twanging as the bees go boom, 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 as they hit the strings trying to get back in through their front doors.
Were you on a separate cello playing to them, or were you playing their hive?
No, I was playing their hive. Yeah. I was covered in bees. I had bees in my hair. The gap between the fingerboard and the strings is weirdly wide on this cello. It's a terrible cello. And there were bees underneath the strings. I was playing in and around the bees, playing their hive to see whether they would respond to the vibrations.
Now, while we do not have audio of Kate playing the bee cello, what we do have for you is a recording made by the wife of the aforementioned physicist who cooked up this radical scheme. His name is Martin Benčík, an academic at Nottingham Trent University, and his wife heard here playing this honeycomb-filled instrument, along with its bees, is Deidre Benčík. The Benčíks have generously made this audio available for us to share with you.
Thank you.
was our brief detour from the main business in this episode of Kate's research into the life of Pal Hermann and his cello. When you consider her fascination for the very physicality of a cello, a certain poetic vision can easily open up, I think, relating to all the possibilities of life that might imbue and inhabit a musical instrument in ways both figurative and literal. Let's resume now with this Nazi-era story of an artist, and we're going to pick up right where we left off before the interlude. The cello vanishes, as you say, and decades after, here's Kate Kennedy following the story of Pal Hermann, and one of the things you've got to be wondering is what did he actually sound like? There was at least one, maybe a few extant recordings of him playing. You got your hands on them. Tell us about what it's like when you have already done your historical research and you've learned about the missing cello and you want to learn about what his life was like and his fate in Lithuania. You were wondering, where are these recordings?
He did make some LPs, and they're very warped, so you can hear him, and it's tantalizing because it's like hearing a ghost. You know, I'd seen his photo so many times. I'd learned everything I possibly could about him, worked with the family, and traveled to the places. So we stepped in his footsteps. But to hear his cello on these records was incredible, but also really frustrating because it showed me how close I couldn't quite get because they were so warped. It was like he was playing underwater, you know, it's this sort of sound. You could hear that it's really nice playing. You could hear that it's stylistic, that he shapes phrases really beautifully, but it wasn't the real thing. It was a kind of, not quite a mockery, I wouldn't be that strong, but something like that. It was frustrating and disappointing, and I longed to hear that sound of that cello that he knew so well that shaped his career, shaped his playing.
We've talked about the importance of the instrument to him and to you, the importance of it, the extension of the body that the instrument becomes for so many musicians. It's one thing to have that amputation of the instrument, but Pal Hermann had other tragic losses, being carried off to the concentration camp, leaving his daughter behind, and even before that, the loss of his wife. I want you to help paint a picture here of who he was before even being hauled off to the concentration camp in the family life, because I understand that some of your research put you in close contact with some of his survivors as you were retracing his steps.
Yeah, I mean, I was incredibly lucky. You know, biographers are made or broken by the living family members of their subject. And I was incredibly lucky with Pal Hermann's living relatives. So his daughter, who is the most wonderful woman, Corrie Hermann, who's now in her mid-90s, was incredibly helpful. And we got to be very, very close and traveled together and traipsed across Paris and France together. And her son, also called Paul van Gastel, who lives in Italy, was extremely helpful. And he is passionate about trying to recover his grandfather's reputation and trying to find his music from whatever archives we can, trying to kind of put the pieces of the jigsaw back together to find this man who he, of course, never met. Pal Hermann was killed when his daughter Corrie was 7. So she remembers him very, very clearly. But for 85 years, she has not heard the cello sound that she knew so well. She's been deprived of having mother or father, because when she was 1, he had to leave his little daughter Corrie with loving relatives, but he couldn't earn a living. He was forbidden to earn money as a Jew in Holland, non-native to Holland. And so he lost absolutely everything. He lost his wife, he effectively lost his daughter, he lost his home, and all he had was this cello. And I've talked about how much the cello is your soul and how close it is to your body. But when it's literally all you have, that relationship is so much more intense. And so to me, it became a passion to try to recover that lost instrument, which had vanished in the 50s. Because if I could restore that to lovely Corrie Hermann towards the end of her life, you know, what would it mean to her to hear her father's voice effectively from beyond the grave, that a sound that she will kind of know in her bones instinctively, but hasn't heard for 85 years. And so that was my passion. And I had very reluctantly to hand the manuscript of the book in to my publishers, having not found the cello. I had any amount of false leads, but I could not find the cello. I found lots of clues about it. It was so frustrating, so tantalizing. I knew that it was very distinctive. I knew it was unique, but I just couldn't put my hand on it.
This goes to something you said as well. You said that maybe, just maybe, if Corrie Hermann could ever hear that instrument, that Galliano cello being used in performance, that her father's soul might be heard because of that instrument. And I don't think you mean that just metaphorically. You've told stories about, you've told stories about the British cellist Julian Lloyd Webber, brother to Andrew, saying essentially that a cello knows the music that's been played on it and will kind of recognize it?
Yeah, to Julian. Yes, absolutely. He really believes that the cello plays itself. You're just there for the ride sometimes. You know, he played a great Stradivarius, and he tried for the first time the Delius cello concerto on it, and it was like trying to hold back a racehorse, he said. It was just playing it itself. The cello knew this. And then he realized that actually it had been premiered on that instrument, you know, decades and decades before.
The Delius piece had been premiered on that very instrument.
On that Stradivarius, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And he didn't know that when he had this kind of strange out-of-body experience with it.
Are you personally swayed by this?
I love it. I love it. I love these ideas. I love to play with them. Everybody has a different relationship to their cello. And, you know, and it was just wonderful collecting all these thoughts and these ideas. There is something almost sort of ineffable about that relationship. But actually, it's nuts and bolts and resonance and, you know, and what sounds match. So you can be very cynical and reduce it. But also, you cannot deny that there is something other about this. There is something rather sublime about it, which I love.
To understand what's actually at stake in this incredibly strange proposition of an inanimate cello somehow remembering music that was once performed on it, and then reviving it at some later date under the able hands of a renowned artist like the cellist Julian Lloyd Webber, well, it may help to remember the sheer miracle of music altogether and our embodied reception of music. Here are the first solo notes of the concerto by Frederick Delius that Kate was referring to. It's the piece Lloyd Webber performed on an instrument he claimed could remember that piece. Not many decades ago, an audio recording of any kind, including music, would have been thought a complete fiction. And as long as we're talking miracles, sometimes I'm guilty of forgetting just how miraculous concrete musical vibrations are in themselves, to say nothing of the miracle that organic material like human brains and hearts are able to process these vibrations as music. You know just as I do, our internal physical organs of hearing must respond to external sound waves, and this sound must enter our physical bodies before it can ever touch our souls. Given such an astonishing reality as all of that, a cello might be capable of anything at all. I've got another podcast to recommend to you from the BYU Radio family of podcasts. It's called The Appleseed. Each episode features master storytellers sharing all kinds of stories for you and your family, folk tales, fairy tales, personal and family tales. It's ideal for road trips, bedtime, or any time you're looking for something that the whole family can enjoy together. And here's a great side effect of listening to The Appleseed. It has a nearly magical ability to conjure up a whole lot of healthy storytelling right at home, and it often prompts the sharing of precious memories as well. Be sure to catch The Appleseed wherever you get your podcasts. We now return to Constant Wonder. Writer, producer, and musician Kate Kennedy is with us in this episode of Constant Wonder from BYU Radio. I'm Marcus Smith. Kate, would you share with us a few thoughts now about Paul Hermann, bereft of his cello, imprisoned in Lithuania, about to die? Your subtitle to the book Cello is A Journey Through Silence to Sound. Suddenly he's in the world of silence. And I understand that you are acquainted with some sites. Well, the site in Lithuania. You've been there.
Yeah, I have.
Walk us into that silence, given everything you've said about music and the cello.
Sure. It was one of the great privileges of this research to be able to retrace these great cellists' steps. But of course, these stories very often were very dark and very complicated and very tragic. And I had the most wonderful time with dear Corrie Hermann going around Paris in a taxi and going around Toulouse. But there were places where she could not go because what had happened to her father there was so awful. And that included Drancy internment camp in Paris, where all the Jews in France were rounded up. And of course, it included this ghastly, ghastly place in near Kaunas in Lithuania called the Fort of Death. I mean, just the name gives you an idea. I've never been anywhere so bleak. It's a squat fort, I think built in about the 1840s. It's a site of any amount of unspeakable atrocities. Russians used it for genocide. It's the site of the second biggest genocide in Lithuania as incurred by the Nazis. And it was simply a killing site. People weren't held there for very long. They were rounded up in the ghettos, taken to these horrible, dark, thick-walled, damp cells with barred windows, herded in there for a night or two, and then taken out and walked between two high mounds of earth through a gate. And then there were snipers, machine guns on either side of the mounds. There were burning pyres to the side. And there is still a wall there that is known as the killing wall because it's just full of bullet holes. And that was where, after 2 days, they took Hermann and 800 other Frenchmen who they'd taken off Convoy 73 and kept them in the cell for a few days, and then walked them out in groups down this kind of cursed walk with a copse of spruce trees on the hill. And this was something that really struck me alongside all this horrendous, horrendous stuff and this awful wall that still bears the scars of what happened there. There was this copse of spruce trees to my left, and I realized with this sort of heart-stopping moment that was really one of the last things Powell would have seen. And that his cello that he'd lost was also made of spruce. He'd had this close, close physical relationship with this wonderful resonant spruce wood that was so all about life. And yet these spruce trees were there bearing witness and still are this extraordinary sort of silent witness as to what went on there. And so they burnt the bodies in big piles, scattered them in the fields around the fort. And that was the last we ever heard of Paul. And I was there extraordinarily on the day in which Putin invaded the Ukraine. And Lithuania has Russian television. They firmly believed that within hours, potentially, they would be next. And so it was the weirdest moment where I was deeply immersed in the worst atrocities of the Second World War. And it felt like the Third World War was unfolding around me. And then we went back to the cell and found that because it had been whitewashed at various points, it had been used as a food store, like the most unhygienic food store ever. It was so damp, with water streaming down the walls. But this whitewash had peeled and revealed graffiti that the prisoners in the cells had written, which is, of course, it's what prisoners do. The Tower of London has very famous graffiti. But it's all you've got. It's the only way of making a mark on the world when you know you're about to be erased. And we found written there, nous sommes 900 Français, we are 900 Frenchmen. And that was the Convoy 73. It could have been Hermann writing it. There were a few names, Emile, 1944. And so I sat under that writing, trying to be some kind of witness to what had happened there. And I played Hermann's music. So although he was silenced, it felt in some way that if I could have his music heard in that space, and it was recorded and it's now played there on a loop, apparently, that somehow I could fill that silence with sound, even though, of course, it isn't restorative. It doesn't even begin to touch the sides of repairing the damage that was done there. It's my act of homage to him. And that was an extraordinary moment. I've never heard a cello sound so mournful as it did in this incredibly resonant, dripping, wet space with this writing behind me.
What piece did you play?
I played Bach. I played the second suite in D minor, which is very, very dark. But I played Hermann's Cello Concerto, which is the most awesome piece. And it's just been rediscovered very recently. The family found the papers in a drawer. And then, thinking the orchestral parts were missing, then found them as well. So it's now been recorded and it's a great piece. It's had to be reconstructed. It's really just the first movement, but the rest of it's been constructed from his own music, from songs and other and chamber pieces. It's full of life. It's full of energy because he was, you know, 26 or so when he wrote it. He was a young, fabulous, fun man, full of potential. And so it felt good to play that as well as the Bach, which is overwhelmingly powerful and sad. And there was something about stirring the air there with Hermann's vigor and these rhythms that he plays with so much that felt like it was important to do as well.
Well, the time has come now for us to go back and follow up on the missing cello. It had vanished from this story when it got sold off.
The book came out with the cello missing. I had to make my peace with the fact that it wasn't from silence to sound. It was silence to silence, really, you know. But what happened, which was, I still can't quite get over it, was that I'd put together this theatre piece, this performance, this sort of two-hander performance with the cellist Natalie Klein, as a book launch. And we put together this show with me speaking and playing and her playing. And it was at the Wigmore Hall in London at the end of September. The book was published in August. And I had a call from Julian Lloyd Webber saying, a friend of mine, a Chinese cellist, Jan Wang, has read your book. And it was tremendously moved by the story of Corrie and her father, because Jan also has a daughter who's 7. So he really related to it. And of course, in the book, I describe the Niccolo Galliano cello in great detail, and there are photographs of it. And I should say that one of the key reasons why it was so tantalizing and maddening that I couldn't find it was that I had discovered at great length, I mean, real detective work, that it actually had an inscription burnt around its ribs, which is really unusual. I didn't know whether it was a big burnt-in inscription or whether it was a pattern or, you know, or whatever it was. But I did learn that it included the Latin writing, ego anima musicae sum, which, of course, is the biggest gift, considering all the themes you've talked about. I am the soul of music. You know, this. I knew this was Paul Hermann's soul, and it was like the cello was confirming it for me. But that's like a tattoo or a birthmark. Cellos look a lot like other cellos, but one with burnt-in writing in Latin, that I've never seen a cello like that. You know, someone somewhere will have seen that cello. And so I did huge calls out over international networks of dealers and makers across the BBC, every contact I could think of. Someone somewhere will recognize and remember seeing this cello with this writing. And sure enough, Jan Wang thought he remembered a Galliano cello that was being played in a big international cello competition that he was judging. And he thought he remembered seeing some writing around the sides. And of course, I was pretty much shaking by this point in the phone call, but also thinking, yeah, but we've been here about 20 times and it's never the right cello. So who knows, you know. But then he found some photos online of this wonderful young Australian cellist who'd been the competitor. And he compared them with the photos and the detail I could give in the book, which, of course, before publication, we hadn't really been able to do. You know, it was because the book existed, this was possible suddenly. And they were the same. The writing was the same. Ego anima musicae sum. There were the letters curving around. This fabulous young player, Sam Lucas. All the photos on the internet confirmed that this was undoubtedly the same cello. And so I had this extraordinary cold calling this chap, Sam. I was standing on the Strand in London, this busy street. I couldn't even wait to get in a building. I just had to track this guy down. Found his number, called him and said, look, you don't know me, but would you mind awfully getting on a plane pretty much now, flying to perform at the Wigmore Hall in a couple of days' time, and also learning a really hard piece of music you've definitely never heard by a guy called Paul Herman, who you've certainly never heard of. And could you come and play it with Natalie Klein and me? And bless his heart, rather than thinking I was crazy, Sam said, yeah, okay. And he did. And again, incredibly lucky for us, he's a stunning player. He even looks like Paul Herman. And he absolutely got the spirit of this quest, you know. So over he came. The first time I heard the cello was on the BBC's Today programme on Radio 4, because Sam had literally just flown in, gone straight to the BBC studio. Corrie and I were in the studio in Oxford. She's in her mid-90s now. And she was sitting there with her headphones on, and the presenter said, and now Sam will play this to Corrie. Corrie, you know, see if you recognise this. And he started to play Herman's music. And Corrie, who is... she's a cool customer, you know, she's not emotional. She's had to survive this story all her life, and she's pretty tough, you know. I just saw her face transform. She was seraphic, and like she was nodding, and no one else apart from me in the studio could really see this. You know, you don't get that on the radio, but she's saying, yes, yeah, that's it. That's my father. And then later that day, Sam came to the Wigmore and we performed, and right at the end of the performance, on Sam came, and everyone was in tears, and we took the whole audience down with us. You know, Corrie in the audience with her son, Paul Van Gastel, and Sam came on stage and said, Corrie, I would like to play your father's music to you, where he played 100 years ago. You know, he played on the Wigmore stage regularly. And so the UK premiere of a snippet of Herman's concerto happened on Herman's cello for the first time in, yeah, goodness knows how long, 85 years at least. It was one of those unrepeatable career moments where you felt like something had really changed in the world in that moment. And in fact, it actually kind of had, because the president of the European Union picked it up, and we were invited to the European Parliament to commemorate the Holocaust Memorial Day and the 80th anniversary of the liberation of the camps. And so there was tiny little Corrie, who's very, very short, right in the middle of the European Parliament building with the cello on its stand next to her, having a standing ovation from all these MEPs, cameras everywhere, telling her story. And then Sam played the cello. And again, I don't think I'll beat that in a long career. It really felt like something had really happened. And this cello had been brought out of its silence, and its story had been told.
Well, Kate, you are a seasoned broadcaster. You tell a story, you shape a story, you weave a story so well. And we've been able to hear part of what you cover in your book. And it's not just about the one cellist, Paul Herman. When you, in this very moment, just pause, maybe take a deep breath, reflect on the fact that since the publication of the book, you helped... had a hand in locating this cello and bringing it together with Corrie, making that all happen, witnessing it yourself, hearing the tones of that instrument, having been to the concentration camp in Lithuania. What do you experience now? Just think, I mean, it's one thing to give the details, but just, it's kind of gobsmacking to me that anybody should have a hand in this kind of a thing. And you did.
It's just the biggest privilege. It really is, because you had no idea. If someone had said to me as I was ferreting around on the internet in lockdown, you're going to be standing at the centre of the European Parliament with a standing ovation, and you will have changed this woman's life and given her some peace that she's never had, I can't do that. I'm just some random biographer. You know, what do I know? And so the wonderful cumulative momentum that when you start to tell a story and you believe in it and you draw people in and you build communities around that storytelling and they grow and they grow and these amazing people come and they offer something new and they help join you on your journey, then miracles happen. Then incredible things happen. And I'm still finding that these wonderful aftershocks keep coming. You know, I seem to have become the spokesperson for silenced musicians. I'm leading this kind of campaign for let's hear injured musicians talk about the stigma of injury. And that was a totally random side effect of publishing this book and finding the cello after publication and all the effect that has had and what that story with that object at the centre of it has come to represent, to speak on behalf of the millions who were silenced by genocide is an incredible privilege.
So you've performed now, as you've said, a whole lot more, simply in connection with your investigation into the stories of Pal Herman and three other past cellists of note. The other three, I really ought to mention. These are lives we clearly and sadly can't get to just for want of time in this episode. Well, they are Lisa Cristiani, that's another forgotten performer. Cristiani is considered to have been the first professional female cello soloist. She made her mark on the global scene by embarking on an epic concert tour of Siberia that was in the 1850s, and she was playing a Stradivarius cello. And then Anita Lasker-Wallfisch. Lasker-Wallfisch, she played in the orchestra at Auschwitz and survived incarceration both there and in Bergen-Belsen. Then the last of the four that you write about, Amedeo Baldovino, his Stradivarius went down in a shipwreck in South America, but was then later recovered and repaired. The fifth cellist in your book is, of course, you, in the way of autobiography rather than biography, and you disclose personal heartfelt reasons for weaving these various strands all together. So maybe we could draw this all to a conclusion by reflecting on your private experience through all of this historical and creative work and sleuthing for the book. Has your relationship with your own instrument, after everything you've discovered and learned, has that relationship changed?
Yes, it really has. And I was hoping it would, but I wasn't expecting it. I was prepared to use that as a kind of literary device. You know, this is my journey. This is my quest narrative. But actually, it tricked me out of my cynicism, and it really did change. Because my calling card all around Europe was my playing. And it wasn't about whether it's perfect, whether it's good. It was about the conversation it can trigger, what the silence after you've played Bach to someone allows them to give you. And so I'm playing all the time. You know, I'm going around all these festivals around Europe, around the UK, playing and talking. And it's just fabulous. It frees me up from the anxiety of worrying about whether or not my arm will hold out, because it's not about me. It's about what this music can achieve. And it's about just the knowing the privilege of being able to make it when others can't. And I hold their stories. And I have the opportunity potentially to be able to use my arm well. It has long periods of being able to be fairly okay. It's not perfect. I don't think it ever will be, but I can play. And I celebrate that now rather than try and ignore it, because I know I can't rely on it and it's a source of pain. It's now a source of opportunity. And that's a real seismic shift for me.
This is going to sound like a leading question, and I suppose it is. I asked you about your private, intimate relationship with your instrument, and in your answer, you kind of went public again about performance and not being self-conscious, and those are all great things, perfectly great things. I guess my leading question is, when you're alone now, just practicing, and you have an instrument, and it's yours, has that kind of a moment of just togetherness with that one other person, the cello, has that changed?
Yeah, it really has. previously the cello might be in its case over the other side of the room or somewhere else. Now it sits out of its case in a stand waiting for me to pick it up. And a lot of the book was written with a cello at my feet. I had, you know, laptop and cello around me. And so I'd stop typing for a bit and I'd sit and play and then I'd go back to the typing. And it became like breathing. It became a natural gesture rather than something painful and forced. And so the cello was part of my conversation with myself as I was writing this. It has its own voice being woven in because I was typing or then bowing and then typing again. And so it's speaking with me through this book. And just having your cello's voice, having your voice as a cellist back again is transformative. It really is.
Kate Kennedy's book is titled Cello, A Journey Through Silence to Sound. This episode was produced by Jess Scoville with assistance from Lily Jensen. Audio of Sam Lucas performing an excerpt from the Pal Herman Cello Concerto at Wigmore Hall was used with permission from Kate Kennedy. And the recording of Kate herself playing from Bach's Second Cello Suite on site in Kaunas, Lithuania, was used with permission from both Kate Kennedy and from the Kaunas Ninth Fort Museum. Sound designed by James Call. I'm Marcus Smith. The Constant Wonder Podcast is a production of BYU Radio.